Welcome back to the program. While we often enter wars with the best of intentions, the reality is often quite different. The reality in almost all wars is the death not just of enemy soldiers, but of hundreds of thousands of civilians whose death, at best, becomes a statistic. Yet it's hard for us to grasp this reality. Perhaps it's our own myopia, our inability to see or relate to those that might be different than ourselves, or a need to look away for fear of feeling a kind of collective guilt. Whatever the individual reason, the new reality of high-tech warfare is arguably making this increase in civilian casualties all the more a reality disconnected from the body politic. We're going to talk about the impact of civilian casualties in war today with my guest, John Tierman. He's principal research scientist and executive director of the Center for International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his latest work, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. John Tierman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for joining us today. One of the things that you talk about are these two studies that were done relatively recently with respect to the civilian casualty count in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the things that is so shocking, I suppose, is the general public apathy that has surrounded all of this.
Yeah, that's what the reason I wrote this book came about, because of these studies and the lack of interest in what was happening to the populations that we were meant to protect or liberate. It was very striking to me that after the Johns Hopkins Household Survey in 2006, which found over 600,000 people had died in Iraq as a result of the war, there was a sort of a 1 or 2 day story, and then it sort of disappeared from the news media, and indeed, even today, major journalists like Anderson Cooper or, you know, the New York Times and others will refer to the number of casualties in Iraq in the tens of thousands, when it in fact must be now close to 1 million. And so I wanted to look at this apathy, this indifference. And I went back and looked at the Korean War, the Vietnam War, as well as Iraq and Afghanistan.
One of the things that makes Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan as well more complicated, I suppose, in the context of this, is that these were wars in some ways of liberation, not just against an enemy army or an enemy leader, but wars that were perpetrated in the name of liberating the citizen population, and yet we have this indifference to citizen casualties. There's this inherent contradiction in all of that.
Well, there is, and I think that it can be explained in a couple of ways. One is that, there's always a rally around the flag opinion in the American public at the beginning of a war. There may be some ambivalence about it in the run-up to war, as there was in the Iraq War situation, but it, generally speaking, the public in this country rallies to the war, and part of the reason that they do is that the war is often sold in part as a rescue operation or something of the kind for the people living in those countries, save them from communism, save them from Saddam, save them from somebody.
Right.
But in fact, leaders go to war basically to protect our own interests, not really to protect those civilians. I mean, it's a secondary at best consideration, the civilians. So they're easily lost in the shuffle when the war either goes badly or we achieve aims in the short term, but things tend to erode in terms of public opinion. And part of that erosion, I think, has to do with the scale of violence and the turning away from that violence, which then translates into lower support for the war itself.
What about for those that are engaged in the war, for the soldiers and the military leaders that are engaged, and how it impacts them, particularly within the context of the kind of counterinsurgency wars that we're engaged in today, but in even going back to Vietnam, where it was arguable that we were fighting for the hearts and minds of the people?
Well, I try very hard to understand the position of the soldier and the Marine and the airman in these wars. The The fact is that they're trained and then ordered to do certain things. They're rarely actually told to kill civilians. I mean, this must be made very clear. But civilians often are in the way, and force protection, what is called force protection, which means protecting our own soldiers, is always the first priority, and then carrying out whatever mission is the second priority, and civilians are often the ones that get the short end of the stick, so to speak. So the soldiers, by and large, are just carrying out a mission, and I think for the most part, they do not want to harm civilians. I mean, I don't think there's any malicious intent there. But, of course, a lot of the killing is done by air. A lot of it is done by long-range artillery. Some of it is as a consequence of war, the collapse of a healthcare system, for example, not direct violence from the war. So the soldiers, you know, I think, by and large, are not the perpetrators, so to speak. I think that the more commanding officers that know what they're doing, need high body counts and the like, are much more culpable. But in general, I think it's just a consequence of war. You know, once you start a war, you don't know what's going to happen, and this is one of the great truths of war that policymakers often overlook when they start another one.
Does technology and the increased mechanization of war, to the degree that it is even achieved today with drones and everything else, does that have an impact in further disconnecting us from the process?
Well, drones do, certainly to some extent, although the use of drones is just beginning to become more and more frequent. It wasn't so much in the period I was covering in Iraq. Interestingly enough, a researcher at Harvard told me that they had found that the suicide rate among all American military personnel, which is actually rather high, was highest among drone operators, oddly enough. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that. But I think the more general question, does a new technology make it easier? I think, you know, you go back to Korea 60 years ago using World War II technology, the killing was just astronomical. 3 million people died in 3 years in Korea. Very bloody affair. So the newer technologies, I don't think, really matter that much in what we're talking about.
Is there a greater sensitivity today, even given the apathy that we started out talking about in these surveys that were done and the numbers that came back? Is there a greater sensitivity, do you think, today than there was during Korea or Vietnam?
I think that there is some. I think that there is, Korea, there's very little evidence of public concern about what was happening to the Koreans themselves, both the South Koreans and the North Koreans. It's hard to measure because there weren't opinion surveys and there was very little sort of cultural expressions of concern. So it's hard to know what the public was thinking in those years. But Korea became a very remote war. It's often called the Forgotten War. And so it's a different kind of animal than most of the rest of these. I think that there is more sensitivity in the sense that the wars are covered more heavily. They're not always covered in a way that I think is, you know, emphasizing the civilian suffering, but at least the wars are covered very extensively. And there are some NGOs, particularly human rights groups and others, that keep raising questions about what's happening morally in the war. And I think that's helpful, but it seems to be pretty marginalized.
How much of this reaction, particularly domestically, comes from our own kind of narcissism, our own inability sometimes to look outward and to even make the effort to understand people different than ourselves?
Well, I think there's a lot to that. We are a fairly insular country despite our size and our global reach. One of the things that I wrote about in my book is that we have had a kind of a frontier mentality has been one of the major frames for understanding American expansion in the world, and at first, of course, was the was the way we expanded across the North American continent, the European settlers coming all the way to your part of the world. And then after the frontier more or less closed in the late 19th century, we began to look out to the rest of the world. And part of the attitudes that attend this frontier myth is a certain sense of superiority, moral superiority. And so it's a funny combination of both detachment but also a belief in our own destiny and our own rightful actions in the world. And this is a tricky combination. I think it does explain a lot of the indifference. When things start going badly, we just don't want to know about it because it doesn't fit with our own sense of ourselves.
Even in the context of how globalized we talk about the world being today, when you look at the number, how few Americans have passports, for example, it sort of feeds into this very point.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's also the case that we don't want to engage with people from other countries that much, unless they come into our neighborhoods, but in which case we get along with them rather well for the most part. But what I think is relevant to this is that we don't want to listen to, say, the voices from Vietnam or the voices from Iraq. I mean, just think back on how many times have you actually heard an Iraqi talking about the war that has beset their country for the last 8 years? You just don't hear it. It's just not part of our communications world. Even with the differences in communications and translation abilities and so on, we're not hearing this.
And why not, in your view? Why do you think the media even has ignored that?
Well, it's interesting that the U.S. media does so, I think, more than, the European media, much less those in the developing world. And I think it does go back to this insularity. We simply are not that interested in listening to these voices. Now, with respect to the war itself, I think there's a reason, and that is because what will an Iraqi say to us? Well, they're probably going to say, we don't like what you've done to our country.
Right.
And therefore, it's not a very happy message. And, you know, the television in particular is very sensitive to appearing to be anti-American, and so they're not likely to go out on that limb.
There was a belief, though, it never really materialized, that post 9/11, that we would look out at the world in a different way, in a more aggressive way, in a more open way, because we had been touched by things in other parts of the world that had not impacted us in our insular way before. But it never worked out that way.
Well, it's interesting. You know, this question, why do they hate us? Remember that
right,
kept
sure.
popping up right after 9/11. And there was some discussion about that I thought was useful. But one of the reasons that people in the developing world particularly are upset with the United States, I don't know if it's hate so much as being a kind of a puzzlement and a feeling of why is the United States doing this to us, you know, is that we are intervening in place after place militarily, often on the side of dictators in some cases, certainly bad actors. You know, we supported Saddam Hussein for a long time in Iraq. But even where we're trying to do something right, like in Libya, I think, it looks to many in the Arab world as, well, we're intervening in Libya, not in Syria, and what's the difference, right? Well, one difference, is that Libya has oil. Now, that may not be the reason we're actually there, but it certainly looks like that to a lot of people. So American actions very often look self-interested and look clumsy and brutal, you know, coming in with huge amounts of military force. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have a bad reputation in many parts of the world.
There was a belief also for a while, and maybe it's true to a certain extent, that the increase in new media would have an impact on making some of these moral situations clearer to Americans.
Yeah, I looked at the new media angle on the Iraq war particularly because I was quite interested in it, partly because I followed a lot of the war through the new media. There are some very informative websites like Juan Cole, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, He speaks Arabic. He has a very deep historian's understanding of the war, and that was very helpful from analysis. But there was very little news, actually, on the Internet. It tended to be repackaged from newspapers. And so we didn't really get much except a lot of opinions. And the opinions tend to reinforce our own opinions. I mean, after all, I tend to go to websites that reflect my own view of the world rather than another. And that's one of the sad things about the demise of newspapers is that for all their shortcomings, it was a common platform for people to go and get information and discuss it. But I think the new media has a great deal of potential to give us more news and more useful information about the rest of the world, but it's not quite there yet.
What we're getting instead is the long tail of confirmation bias, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of opinion, basically, and some of it's more clever than others, and some of it is useful. I mean, some of it is analysis, but there's very little news on the Internet that isn't already in some other news media form.
One of the broader issues that you also talk about is the psychological aspect of this and how people react to seeing the horror of war, the psychological reaction, and this tendency sometimes to blame the victim. Talk a little about that.
Well, I went back to, in trying to explain this indifference that I perceived, I went back to a set of theories that had been developed in social psychology, one of which is called just world theory. And it was fascinating, actually, because it's been proven in many, many tests, you know, experiments, psychological experiments over many years. And what it is this, briefly, is that we, you know, we construct our world to be orderly and to make sense to us. And when that world is disrupted for some reason, this just world, as it sometimes is called, when this just world is upset or disrupted, we react, and we react in a variety of ways. One is to simply turn away from and deny the reality. Sometimes we view it in a way that blames the people who are being victimized. I'll give you a quick example. You're walking down the street and you see somebody in a wheelchair begging. The typical reaction to that is going to be to ignore that person. But often people actually get angry that somebody is there begging, and they tend to think that that person in the wheelchair is responsible for their own misfortune. I mean, this has been proven in many clinical tests. It's an unfortunate thing, but what explains it is that we don't like to be confronted with the possibility that someone in America could be begging on the street and not be taken care of. And you extend that to a situation of a war where there are many, many civilians, innocent people, who are being victimized, sometimes by the United States, sometimes by others involved in the war, and so on. But nevertheless, they are being victimized, and we simply do not want to acknowledge that this was a possible outcome of this war that we were a major participant in. And often the victims themselves are blamed for their own misfortune. So, for example, with respect to Iraq, you often hear this said that most of the violence is Iraq-on-Iraq violence, that they're killing each other and, you know, it's sort of their problem. Well, yes and no. It's true that they are often killing each other, but they weren't killing each other before we intervened. So there is it's a complex set of attitudes that derive from our need to have a comforting, orderly world, and when that's disrupted, we react in these different ways, either denial, blaming the victim, or other similar reactions, and that's what I think we're seeing with these wars.
And of course, as a basis for this, as a baseline in these wars, is something that you touched on a little bit earlier with respect to the stages of war, and always at the beginning this rally around the flag, and one of the things that comes with is usually a certain degree of propaganda that led us into the war in the first place, and a set of preconceptions about the people that we're going up against.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that that you know, it's not a coincidence that the wars we've mainly been involved in, the major wars we've been involved in, have been in Asia since World War II, and they have been against you know, in countries, I shouldn't say against countries, because very often we're there supposedly to defend people, but they've been in countries where a lot of stereotypes about, you know, East Asians, about Arabs, really come into play very dramatically as soon as the war begins. You know, they don't care as much about life, they don't believe in democracy, you know, all kinds of things that are just under the surface. And they begin to become more prominent when things go badly. So there's a certain amount of racism that's involved, although I don't think we're any different in that respect than France or Britain or other great powers that have been involved in their own colonial wars.
As you've looked at this with respect to other wars, not wars necessarily that the U.S. has been engaged in, do you see the same tendencies, the same apathy, the same indifference we've been talking about with respect to civilian death in other wars and other nations?
I have to say that I haven't looked at it in great detail, but I think that it, with respect to the British, for example, or the French, say, in Algeria in the 1950s and 60s, I think there are very similar attitudes. They're not quite the same. I think the British looked at their colonial empire in a more instrumental way. That is, that they saw the empire as something that was going to benefit them, not so much as a moral project, so to speak, the way we look at our interventions. Now, that's not absolutely true, because there was a certain amount of that in the British Empire as well. But by the time the empire was coming apart and they had to start to fight wars in Malaysia and Palestine and elsewhere, they had an attitude of more, well, is this a profit or a loss for Britain? And in that context, you don't feel the same kind of apathy or reactions, or at least not for the same causes. And I think the same was true of the French. But it would be too large a claim to say that we are entirely different than the French, the British, the Russians, and others who have had large empires. I think there are strong similarities.
What all of this, the political side of it and the psychological side, what it all does is also seems to beg the larger and broader moral questions that are inherent in all of this.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what led me to this to begin with, which was, you know, in Iraq by 2006, it appeared as though several hundred thousand people had died, many of those, if not most of them, civilians. And yet we just didn't seem to care about this. And I found this really, really appalling, that we could be so active in these wars with all this heavy technology and large deployments of forces and so on, and simply not pay any heed to the destruction that was being wrought, and in fact denying to a very significant degree that such destruction was going on. I found that morally reprehensible, and I think that this is something that really needs to be engaged much more fully, hence the book, because for one thing, if you think that we only killed, you know, 50,000 or 80,000 in Iraq, and Saddam Hussein was removed as a result of that, you might come to the conclusion, well, you know, that's not such a high price to pay, particularly since we're not paying it. That's not such a high price to pay to get rid of such an odious character. So when the next situation comes around, when we want to get rid of somebody, it won't be so hard to do, because the cost didn't seem very high, the moral cost as well as the material cost. But in fact, it was very high. Is very high, and we have to come to terms with this, because not only is it a moral question, but it is actually a very practical question about how the rest of the world sees us.
John Tierman, his book is The Death of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. It's just out from Oxford University Press. John, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.